From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The final full week of the 2020 presidential campaign is here, and so is another coronavirus outbreak at the White House. Two of Vice President Mike Pence's closest advisors have tested positive. Pence tested negative this morning, and he will continue to campaign this week.
And Pence might preside in the Senate tonight when Republicans will likely push through the confirmation of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court, which recently has weighed in on a number of election-related cases. Joining us now is Carrie Johnson, who covers the Justice Department for NPR. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi there.
Will Pence actually be there tonight, and what's being said about that?
Tanya, this is just in. Politico website is reporting that Pence will not be present for the vote tonight. This does represent a change. As late as yesterday, Mike Pence was telling people he wouldn't miss it for the world. And earlier this morning, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said Pence's attendance was in flux. We do know that several senior Republicans in the Senate said Pence wasn't really needed tonight. There isn't going to be a tie to break, and it may be better for everyone's safety if he stays home.
Will there be any surprises in the voting tonight, do you think?
Well, you know, over the weekend, Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski, who had said she was not happy about this vote taking place so close to an election, said that she would, in fact, ultimately vote in favor of Amy Coney Barrett. She said the judge does have the qualifications and the temperament to sit on the Supreme Court. To me, one of the biggest surprises is that Democrats have maintained mostly a lockstep position here. All Democrats are expected tonight to oppose Amy Coney Barrett. That hasn't happened in a long time for a Supreme Court justice.
Can you give us more about what we can expect? What are plans for her to be sworn into the high court?
Yeah, the president has said that there'll probably be a nice event at the White House tonight. It's not clear where. We are hearing reports from Capitol Hill that senior Republicans are getting invitations to that event. And we do think that the Senate will begin voting tonight around 7:30 p.m. So that could be kind of a late evening for a lot of these lawmakers and for the president, too.
I want to ask you about something else. So Barrett declined to recuse herself from hearing any cases involving the presidential election. How could that affect any post-election cases that come before the court?
Tanya, this could be enormously controversial. Barrett said at her confirmation hearing that she would follow the regulations and maybe consult with her new colleagues on the Supreme Court. But really, the Supreme Court has an honor system about recusals, and no one's going to make her step aside if she doesn't want to. That said, senior Democrats on the Judiciary Committee have already signaled that if Barrett does wind up on the court and she does wind up on a case that helps to decide President Trump's political fate, that could be very damaging for the reputation of the court and for Judge Barrett's reputation, too.
Longtime Supreme Court reporter Linda Greenhouse wrote in the New York Times yesterday that there's really no doubt about how Coney Barrett would rule on abortion, specifically given that she sided with the dissent in a case in Indiana that in part concerned a ban on abortions if the woman's decision was based on a disability like Down syndrome. Would you say that case went under the radar during her rushed confirmation hearings?
Well, you know, abortion was a hot topic at her confirmation hearings. We do know that Judge Barrett signed a letter or an ad back in 2006 that called Roe v. Wade a barbaric legacy, and that she, as a devout Catholic, she believes that life begins at conception. But she refused to answer questions about whether she'd vote to uphold or overturn Roe v. Wade in a later case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. We do know she doesn't think that Roe is a super precedent, which means that it's basically above challenge at this point. She said the landmark case Brown v. Board of Education is, but she noted there are still plenty of challenges with respect to Roe v. Wade and abortion rights around the country.
So what are some of the ways that the court could possibly undermine the right to an abortion without overturning Roe versus Wade that granted it?
A lot of legal experts think that there are many smaller ways to chip away at that precedent set by Roe v. Wade, basically allowing state laws to take hold and upholding state laws that impose restrictions on women seeking abortions, gestational bans, additional medical procedures, and the like. And Chief Justice John Roberts, just in June, in a case out of Louisiana, basically struck down in Louisiana law that would impose more restrictions on medical providers seeking to provide women abortions. But he did signal the court may be open to more abortion restrictions moving forward. And certainly Judge Barrett will be closely watched on those issues when she takes the bench very soon.
While I still have you, where are Democrats right now on expanding the size of the court if Joe Biden becomes president?
This is an interesting and tricky problem for Democrats. Of course, you know, Joe Biden just last night on 60 Minutes said he would like to launch a presidential commission in the event that he wins to study these issues, not just adding seats to the Supreme Court, but maybe the possibility of term limits, 18-year term limits for justices. And some scholars have even talked about Congress passing legislation to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court in some cases. Joe Biden is mostly an institutionalist. He's presided over Supreme Court confirmations as former chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he hasn't wanted to be so bold in the past, but it's been interesting to hear people like Chris Coons, his ally in Delaware, a Democrat, saying that nothing is off the table, and Democrats like Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island have also suggested that they believe Republicans have played such politics with this process in the recent past that there's no holds barred if Democrats take over the Senate moving forward.
There is lots to watch out for. Carrie Johnson covers the Justice Department for NPR. As always, thank you so much, Carrie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, more than a quarter of Americans identify as evangelical Protestants, according to the Pew Research Center. That number is even higher in Texas, and President Trump is counting on those voters to stay with him on Election Day, especially evangelical women in the suburbs. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider talked with some of them and found that their support for the president is not absolute.
Ever since she turned 18, Sarah Damoff has voted her faith. She considered herself a single-issue voter on abortion and supported Republicans. When the Dallas resident couldn't bring herself to vote for Trump in 2016, she wound up voting for a third party instead. After Trump won, she swore she wouldn't do that in 2020.
But here I am again, certain that I do not want to see a second term with Trump, but also not really a fan of the Biden-Harris candidacy. So I, again, feel torn between a third party and a Democratic vote.
For decades, most evangelicals have voted Republican, absorbing the lesson from their communities that the Democratic Party is hostile to their beliefs. But more evangelicals, especially younger women in their 20s and 30s, are wrestling with their vote and their faith this presidential election. For some of his supporters, it seems Trump's policies count more than his character. Here's Kristen Cobb of Northwest Houston.
Trump has protected the unborn. He appointed conservative judges to the judiciary. He supported Israel, and he advocates for religious freedom. And that is something that I believe that, you know, the Word of God tells us that we should be supporting.
And if Trump isn't a perfect vessel, well, no human being is perfect. That's according to Melissa Conway of Friendswood, who says she has personally witnessed Trump growing in his Christian walk.
Is President Trump personally, and through his social media use and his colorful language, a work in progress based upon who Christ is in comparison? Yes, he is. But so am I as a believer.
For many evangelicals, therefore, the choice between Trump and Joe Biden is no choice at all. Here's Kristen Cobb again.
Many of us believe this is actually a fight between good and evil.
But not all evangelicals see Trump as advancing the Word of God. Tess Clark of Dallas was a lifelong Republican. She did not vote in 2016 because she couldn't support Trump, but also didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton because of abortion. Clark says the Bible urges people to care for the foreigner, the stranger, the poor, and that matters just as much as Trump's stance on abortion.
You know, I kept seeing this over and over again and thinking, man, how could I vote for the current administration when all I see them doing is pushing those specific people and those specific categories further into the margins.
This time, Clark says she's voting for Biden. In fact, there may be a generational dispute developing among evangelicals. Stephanie Martin, a professor at Southern Methodist University, calls this trend the rot in the basement of the Republican Party.
If just, 10% or 15% of younger evangelicals get in the habit of voting for Democrats, that would be ruinous to the Republican Party going forward, because it required 80%, 78% of evangelicals to get Donald Trump elected.
But turning your back on a party tied to your faith isn't easy. That's what Tess Clark learned when she voted for Beto O'Rourke for the Senate in 2018.
I've been called by people that I personally know a baby killer. I've been told I can't be a Christian and vote for Joe Biden.
Clark says it's been hard, but she believes if the gospel isn't good news for the poor and the marginalized, then it's not the gospel. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Those were the first words that actor Matthew McConaughey ever uttered on screen for the 1993 film Dazed and Confused, and they've become something of a calling card for McConaughey's career, which includes hit romantic comedies like The Wedding Planner and his Oscar-winning performance in Dallas Buyers Club. Now, Matthew McConaughey has added author to his resume. He took years of his diaries and turned them into a book that's part memoir, part guide to living. It's called Green Lights, and he joins me now on Skype. Matthew, thanks for speaking with us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, good to be here.
Yeah, and you know, we're in such a moment right now. We're locked down in a pandemic, reeling from racial violence. We're on the cusp of a bitter election. Why should people read a book by Matthew McConaughey right now?
Yeah, well, you read Green Lights? It's a good news book about how to deal with the yellow and red lights in our lives, a la many of which you just spoke of. And how to not foolishly, but still find green light assets in the red and yellow light times. You know, green lights are, we love those. They're like a shoeless summer.
Well, let's talk about that. Like, what is a green light?
So a green light is an affirmation, setting yourself up for success. A green light can be as simple as putting your coffee in the coffee filter before you go to bed. So tomorrow morning, all you got to do is push the button. You are teeing yourself up for ease and success and more of yourself in the future. We make those by decisions we make. Sometimes they just fall in our lap.
Well, and you talk about these green light moments throughout the course of your life. Let's talk a little bit about your early days. You grew up, from what I can tell in this book, in a pretty tough family. The way that you write about it feels violent, but also at the same time, full of love. How could that be?
Well, thank you. I'm glad you got that. Because on paper, if you wrote just the facts of some of these things that happened in my childhood, you would call Child Protection Services. You would be like, get the cops over here. This is abuse. But it wasn't.
It wasn't. I mean, I think at one point, one of your brothers hit your dad with a 2x4 in a fight.
Yeah. And after that, they ended up hugging each other and crying it out and became best of friends. Now, I tell the stories of discipline and consequence as love stories in this book because they were the moments where the cocoon of love that we all knew our family had, when that was tested the most. Yet the love never had a chance of losing.
Well, I'll be honest, though. I kind of felt like sometimes you might have been holding back on us a little bit. You wrote extensively about your childhood and some of the conflicts that you had. You wrote a whole chapter about your a year abroad in doing the Rotary in Australia. But then when your father dies, I believe it was in the early 1990s, you spend just a few paragraphs on it. Do you feel like you fully grappled with it?
That's a good question. I did spend time and still do actively spend time dealing with the loss of my father. I rushed back home. We had our late nights and lots of tears for 4 or 5 days with the immediate family. Then we had the Irish wake for him. Then it was about getting back to work. And my family said, this is what your dad would want you to do. It was never out of sight, out of mind. I dealt and learned with my father's passing heavily for the next 3 years after his death. And still do integrate and have him as a part of my life, although only spiritually now, this many years later.
Well, let me ask you about another moment in the book that passed very quickly. In the opening chapter, you take one line to reveal that when you were 18 years old, you were knocked out and molested by a man in the backseat of a van. Is that something that you talk about?
No, I've never shared that. That was new to my mom, my family, to all of my best friends. Yeah, you know, I don't know what I could share in the book that could be constructive about that. All the other stories I tell, there's a constructive way I either learned to deal with it at the time or later on. In this particular instance you're talking about, I don't know what the lesson was to be learned. It was clearly wrong. It was not debatable. And so that clarity, I think, allowed me to compartmentalize that, put that away and go, that was a moment in time. This is not going to define you. You're not going to be heady about this. You're not going to be hung up on this. It was an ugly situation that I've put in the rearview mirror.
Well, look, people are going to want to hear about your personal stories, but also your acting life. And it sounds like acting was pretty far from your mind growing up. You originally wanted to be a lawyer. You then changed your mind. I think in your late teens, maybe early 20s, you switched to film school. And soon after that, you get this just a huge break playing a guy in his 20s named Wooderson, who still hangs out with high school kids. Let's listen to this clip from Dazed and Confused in 1993.
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
There's the same laugh right there. That line pretty much launched your career. And I don't think people realize you had like no acting experience at that point, basically.
No, I didn't have any. I went up to the producer of the film, the casting director of the film, in a bar one night. He later on said, you ever done any acting? I said, no. He goes, well, you might be right for this part. Come down, try it out. I pick up the script. That line in that scene was one of the lines. And you just said an apropos word, launched. That line is what I call a launch pad line. I try to find a launch pad line with every character. But that line, no, that's what I love about those high school girls. I get older, but they stay the same age. I'm like, well, if this person believes that and is not trying to be cool, not trying to play an attitude, well, there's a very thick encyclopedia on this guy. A line like that opened up my eyes into like to the whole character of who Wooderson was to me.
But you weren't famous yet, right? I mean, it launched your career, but it wasn't until 1996 with A Time to Kill, the courtroom drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when you start realizing that you walk down the street and people know who you are. How did you handle becoming famous?
I think I handled it pretty well. I think I enjoyed it, but there was definitely an imbalance to it. I really had to question at that time, well, what really matters? I took a walkabout to a monastery for a while. I took another walkabout to Peru on my own, all these solo trips to go let my own identity catch up, where I could see through what was real at this time, where my feet were not feeling so firmly on the ground.
Because you had become rom-com McConaughey, right?
That was much later. No, 96 after Time to Kill was just pure straight fame. The rom-com stuff came more years later. And at the same time, I was rom-com McConaughey. I was shirtless on the beach McConaughey. All things of which I will always look you square in the eye and go, you damn right, that was me. And those rom-coms paid the rent for those houses on the beach, which is where I was shirtless. Fact. Guilty. At that time, though, I could receive a rom-com script tonight and feel like I could do it tomorrow morning. And there was nothing wrong with that, but I was like, my work's really not challenging me like my life is challenging me. Mind you, Camille and I just had our first child. Boy, an incredibly vital time. So I remember saying, if my life's more vital than my work, that's good, but can my work challenge the vitality of the life I'm living? And I wasn't getting that from the rom-coms. Work I wanted to do to challenge my life's vitality was not being offered to McConaughey. Nobody wanted to make those dramas I wanted to make. So I decided if I can't do what I want to do, I'm going to stop doing what I've been doing. 20 months go by of no work. You have not seen me on any beach sans shirt. You have not seen me in your living room or theater in a rom-com. Where the hell's McConaughey? What happened was after 20 months of being forgotten, I became a new good idea. Lincoln Lawyer, Killer Joe, Magic Mike, Mud, True Detective, Dallas Buyers Club, The Paperboy. It was the Where's McConaughey? And in the Where's McConaughey came the novel idea of, you know who'd be a good idea for this? McConaughey.
Well, and as you say, I mean, it paid off. Dallas Buyers Club, a beautiful biographical film about a man named Ron Woodruff, who learns that he has AIDS in the 1980s, and then he tries to find alternative treatments that aren't available to people. And here you are in a scene with Jennifer Garner, who plays your doctor.
Germany, they got this dextran sulfate, all right? And they got this DDC in France, supposed to keep the healthy cells you got from getting the HIV. And they got AL721 over in Israel. How can I get some of this?
None of those drugs have been approved by the FDA.
Look, screw the FDA. I'm going to be DOA. I gotta sue the hospital to get my medicine.
You won an Oscar for that film, of course, Best Actor. What does it mean to you this many years after it?
You know, that was a very pinnacle moment in my journey of my career. It meant that for me, that as an actor, that as an artist, my product I was putting out, the essence of myself through my characters I was putting out, it was translating. I love that word, translate. What I intended to do is what pretty closely was done. There was not a gap. A lot of times in performances, you know, what we want to do and what we're actually doing and what gets recorded and what you see, there can be a large gap between the four of those. This was a time where I felt like, no, what I intended to do didn't have a large gap as you received it.
Do you think that everybody gets as many green lights as a guy like Matthew McConaughey?
Maybe not. Maybe not. And look, green lights are relative. You know, what kind of green lights am I looking for? We also have to watch that there are certain green lights, and I write about them in the book, that were, you know, battery powered. They're not going to last. They're stops, not stays. I'm looking for the solar powered eternal green lights. That's what I'm chasing. I don't think I'm going to catch all of them, but I don't think that's even what it's about. It's just about chasing them. I think we are our own aspiration, and we should interrogate and investigate ourselves, get to know ourselves as well as possible. And in doing so, we will learn and we find out what our own green lights are. Major green light, think about our eulogy. Just jump up to the objective eye of after we're gone and say, what story is going to be told? And what story is going to introduce me for the rest of time? In that answer, I've found that I feel more like living and living true and hard than I did before asking that question. And I think most people will as well.
Matthew McConaughey, the new memoir is Green Lights. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Pleasure to speak with you. See you next time.
As coronavirus surges in the U.S., Europe is dealing with a second wave. Italy is closing cinemas, swimming pools, and gyms after a single-day record of more than 21,000 new infections. France is extending curfews across the country after reporting more than 52,000 new cases yesterday. Joining us now is the BBC's Guy Hedgeco on Skype from Madrid. And Guy, a similar story where you are. The Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez spoke to the country yesterday and said the situation Spain is going through is extreme. It's the most serious in the past half century. Is it really that bad?
Well, it would seem to be that bad if you take into account the measures that he has taken. Yesterday, he also announced the introduction of a new state of emergency across the country. Now, state of emergencies have only been used a handful of times during Spain's democratic era, and now the prime minister has used two in the space of 1 year. The previous one was to oversee a full national lockdown back in the spring, and now he's using it again in order to allow local governments to introduce more restrictions, not as strict as those we saw back in the spring, but still we have a national curfew in place. And we're expecting more measures to come into place soon. And that is in great part because of the high infection rate in Spain. This second wave has just continued to build really ever since the national lockdown was lifted back in the end of June. And infection rates have continued to rise. There is a lot of worry about the increasing pressure on the healthcare sector.
How are your hospitals doing?
Well, at the moment, the hospitals are handling things okay. I think the real worry is the anticipation of what may come in the winter. Throughout the second wave, the average age of those who've been infected has been much lower than it was in the first wave. And that's in great part because people getting infected have done so by, you know, going out and about. It's younger people, people taking their vacations and so on, or out to the beach or having late night parties, whereas older people have, in many cases, stayed inside and tried to keep away from the risk of infection. But I should point out that the authorities are very much bracing themselves for a tough winter when it comes to your healthcare services. For example, here in Madrid, there is a massive conference center, which back in the spring was converted into Spain's largest hospital. And that conference center is still there. It's still available. It can be used again as a hospital in a moment's notice. So it's quite possible that the authorities may do that again with buildings such as that.
You say the restrictions aren't as bad as they were in the spring during the first lockdown, but you know, this new nighttime curfew could be quite a blow to some people who are hoping their lives could get back to normal. How are people feeling about being ordered back inside?
Well, I think obviously it's frustrating for people. There's a sense of deja vu, the fact that we're seeing the state of emergency again and a certain number of restrictions again. I mean, I should point out that over the last few months, we have seen very localized restrictions being introduced. Now what we're seeing is something a bit more serious. But I think a lot of people that I've spoken to seem to feel that these kinds of measures are necessary. But there are others who are worried in particular about the economy, and they feel that these sort of measures, the way that they affect bars, and restaurants, and hotels, are simply going to destroy the economy.
Similar conversations happening around Europe and around the world. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco in Madrid, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
This is Here and Now. When singer, songwriter, and actor Luke James hit the scene over a decade ago, critics described him as a rising star with unlimited potential. And all I'm trying to say is we got options. Baby, all I'm saying is we got options. The song Options from his 2014 self-titled album garnered a Grammy nomination. And then the music stopped, at least music distributed by a major label. Luke James went on to focus on acting, with roles on Showtime's The Chi and the movie Little with Issa Rae, among others. Now the music is back, and Luke James says his latest album is the first time he's been able to create music that authentically reflects the true him. Luke James, welcome to Here and Now.
How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
You call this latest album, To Feel Loved, as a musical reset. What happened in those 6 years since your last album? And what does this new album reflect about you?
In the last 6 years, I've found myself in a place of looking for love and at the same time not feeling completely loved in totality, not just with my art, but just in my life. And I really just needed time with myself. And it just happened naturally. And I found myself falling out of love with music and the whole rigmarole and whatnot. So when I finally had found the space to get back to creating, I guess I began on the journey of searching for the very things that I felt that I was missing, which was the feeling of love and feeling loved.
So you broke up with Island Records, and you say that this felt like creative freedom for you to be able to put back the pieces of yourself back together in a way that felt authentic for this album, to feel loved, as you say. Let's talk a little bit about your new music from To Feel Loved. I mean, it's just that. It's about love with instrumentation that feels futuristic.
Yeah.
There's also this meditation on what love means. You really hear that with the song Shine On. Let's listen. Collide, you're my beam of light. Shine on. What's great about this, Luke, among lots of things, is that it sounds futuristic, but it's also a chapter from the past. I hear all of that in the sound. Yeah. I mean, how do you define love, and what's the message you're trying to share in this song?
Wow. Love is freeing. It is, in some ways, uncontrollable in the sense of that in order to have that true feeling, you have to let go. You know, and that song Shine On is a recollection of how to feel love and what, you know, what it means to love someone and what it means to receive love and what that feels like. That's exactly what that song is. And I guess it's in some ways a plea for someone to feel okay to love me truly.
You created this music before the pandemic and the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Yeah. You're very much a supporter of social justice causes. Anyone who follows you knows that.
Yeah.
What role do you believe your art plays in responding and reflecting to moments like this?
I think, you know, art, music, and art in totality, I think, has the power and is the way we evolve. It's our communication, our way of communicating and moving to the next level of our humanity. And I believe that my purpose is to instill a sense of empathy, I guess a constant reminder, because that's what it is for me. You know, take time, remember the paths that you've gone down that didn't lead to a place of love, and remember the paths that you did go down that led to love, and share that.
Yeah. You know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about some of your influences, like Marvin Gaye and others who
yes.
made this amazing music during these really pivotal points in history, like the Civil Rights Movement, and
yes.
how you're making music in this particular moment that generations will listen to. Do you think yeah. about this often?
I've thought about it since we've been on quarantine, because of course I've had a lot of time to reflect. But it wasn't, I guess it had never been in my brain fully until now, especially now when I'm creating another sonic wave of things I need that I don't feel I'm getting due to what's going on in the world, the things that I can feel.
Yeah, what's also beautiful about music is that those who listen to it can take their own interpretations and it means something yeah. specific to them. That's the yeah. beauty of it.
That is the beauty.
For me, yeah, one song that I have been loving from To Feel Loved is Gratitude. It really almost feels like you're speaking to everything that's happening this year. Let's take a listen.
If you're able to wake up and see the sunshine, you're blessed. In the storm and the chaos, if you still have your peace of mind, you're blessed. If you're able to love your brother even though they made mistakes, you're blessed. If you thank God that you're able to keep running this human race, you're blessed. No matter where you're from, no matter how many mistakes you've made, you're blessed.
I mean, those lines, if you ever wake up and see the sunshine, you're blessed. In the yeah. storm and the chaos, if you still yeah. have your peace of mind,
peace of
you're
mind,
blessed.
You're blessed. Yes.
Yeah. To me, I can't help but think about how this message of hope is really a message of right now. But what initially inspired that song?
Because sometimes you can let just simple things really make you feel mm-hmm. like the weight of the world is on you. And we just so happened to press record. And as I was saying, I am blessed. We built upon that feeling. And once I lived with just the chant, I knew that I needed a voice. I needed some words that would really help tie it all together and expand on what I was feeling. And so I called a big brother of mine, Kirk Franklin, who was featured on that record, who gave me some words of encouragement, which the words you spoke, mm-hmm. which kind of, I don't know, in a way it kind of opens the floodgates. Mm-hmm. And Kirk Franklin being a voice that I grew up listening to, right? A mm-hmm. voice of reason, a voice of, you know, if I ever felt like I didn't feel my connection to God, I felt it through his music.
Oh, that's such a cool story. And Kirk Franklin yeah. is a friend of the show. He's yes. been on the show. And like you, I grew up listening to him. You know, I bet you hate when reporters ask you questions about choosing between acting and singing, so I'm not going to ask you that.
It's totally fine. I can answer it for you.
Answer it. No, I don't want you to stop doing either, by the way.
I would not stop doing either. I have found purpose in both, but I can't let go of my roots. The very thing that helps me get through my days is song, you know? And mm-hmm. that is something that's within me, and I think, and that is the very thing that has opened the door for me to pursue acting. And so I would choose the mother over the father, for sure.
Yeah. Well, what stories are you drawn to telling as an actor? And how does it influence your music? Do they work in concert with each other?
I just want to be a vessel. I think in my art, music, that's what I'm trying to, you know, I try to summon whatever the spirit calls upon me to let out. That's where I try to be, where I'm not contrived, and it's just pure honesty. And so I guess when I'm looking at a role or a story of some sort, I just want to be where it's honest, where it's telling the truth. And I want to have some fun here and there, but I like to do things that help push the culture forward, help us have conversation, because that's what art is supposed to do. So anytime I have an opportunity to do that, to tell a story, to shine light on a particular lifestyle that isn't quite celebrated in our time, in our world, hopefully I can help us get closer and connected to one another and evolve into a loveful space.
Well, thank you for this conversation, Luke.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is a blessing. Thank you.
That's Luke James, Grammy-nominated artist, whose new album, To Feel Loved, is available now.
Give me your heart and your soul, your body and your brain, your joy and your hurt, pleasure and your pain. Let me feel what you feel and know what you know. Your lies and your truth, your highs and your lows.
CBS broadcast that 60 Minutes interview with President Trump last night. And before the president abruptly walked out of it, Leslie Stahl asked him about these comments at a rally earlier this month.
Suburban women, will you please like me? Remember? Please. Please. I saved your damn neighborhood, okay?
You said the other day to suburban women, will you please like me? Please, please.
Oh, I didn't say that. You know, that's so misleading the way I say jokingly, suburban women, you should love me because I'm giving you security.
Well, those women helped the president win in 2016, but there are signs they're turning away from him in 2020, and it's a part of a bigger story about a gender gap in voting. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us now from Washington. Derek, remind us how important women in the suburbs were for Donald Trump in 2016 and why he's now begging them to come back to him this year.
Well, white suburban women were absolutely critical for Donald Trump in the 2016 election. To put some numbers on that claim, Trump won white women by about 9% in 2016. He won the suburbs by 4%. So you put that together, and the suburban white female majority that Trump enjoyed in 2016 really arguably cinched his victory. This year could not be more different. Polling in swing states shows the president not just losing these voters, but losing by the largest gender gap in American history. Biden is up, according to the New York Times, 23 points among all suburban women, that's white, black, Latina, other, in battleground states. And this arguably is the key story to Trump's lasting deficit against Biden. It's all about women and notably suburban women.
Well, that difference between 2016 and today is interesting because when you look at women overall, we know that they are more likely to vote Democratic, and men are more likely to vote for a Republican. Why is that?
It's really interesting. So in the last two presidential contests, women have actually outvoted men by about 10 million ballots. 10 million ballots is about the equivalent of what Texas, what comes out of Texas every single year, say 2012, 2016. So from an electoral perspective, the United States of women is about a Texas bigger than the United States of men. And it is really important that women do tend to lean Democrat. This is true for white women. It's true for black women. It's actually especially true for Latinas. There's a 26-point Biden advantage among Latina women over Latino men toward Biden. And this is absolutely fascinating to me because this is a trend, the gender gap, that didn't even exist before the 1980s. It was only in 1980, that election that elected Ronald Reagan, that women broke strongly for Democrats for the first time in U.S. history, and demographers coined then the term the gender gap. And since then, it has grown and grown. 8 points in 1980, up to 13 points in 2016. Now it might be 20, 25 points in 2020. This is a huge gap and a hugely explanatory gap because, as you indicated in your question, I do think that in some subtle ways, the Democratic Party has moved toward women on their portfolio of issues, just as the Republican Party has in some ways specialized in gaining that male vote.
But I do want to point out the obvious here. We are talking about broad trends. I've spoken with many women this election season, I'm sure you have as well, who avidly support the president. These are also women who live in the suburbs. So it's not so easy just to paint with a broad brush. However, it is a real thing, and it could affect the election if we take a broader look. On the other hand, let's take a look at the way women and men in the same household vote. husbands and wives? Are they voting the same? Are they voting differently? And is that something that's changed over time?
This is a great question, and the evidence here is a little bit mixed in terms of the degree to which husbands and wives have been voting more differently over time. One thing that demographers see is a phenomenon known as assortative marriages. That's a fancy term for people who are similar to each other are increasingly likely to marry. That would suggest that husbands and wives are voting more like each other than they used to be. But the more important trend, I think, is actually the rise in single-parent households. There are more single mothers than there were 40 years ago. There are more 20-somethings who are single and not married than there were 40 years ago. So single women are a really important force in Democratic, capital D, Democratic politics today, because they are, for a variety of reasons, a strong capital D Democratic voting bloc.
To that point, how much is each political party cementing these gender differences?
So you go back to 1980, when the gender gap first appeared to people who study American politics. And the theory is that Ronald Reagan ran to the right on issues that were important to women. They ran to the right on the Equal Rights Amendment, on abortion, on working women and the idea of traditional families. So Reagan handily wins that election by moving to the right on cultural issues, thereby sorting a lot of conservative men into the Republican Party. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party, this theory goes, specialized more or focused more on those same issues, taking the other side on abortion, on women's right to work, women's education. And so the party specialized in a different kind of politics that appealed to each gender. That essentially is the theory of the gender gap.
Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. A forensic team is searching for victims of the 1921 Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre. We'll talk with a woman whose grandparents survived the violence. That's next time on Here and Now.